Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, and that means it is a true crime time, the first Friday in October. And October is when it starts to feel like fall. And I don't even know why I said that, but I've got Jen with me. Jen, how are you?
I'm good. I also love fall. Not that the West Coast really gets a fall.
We don't, but there's this, what happens is, and I've often said that until this year, I think that October actually had the record for the highest temperature in Los Angeles. But what happens is that even though you get the high temperatures because the sun is starting to go down earlier, that at least you're not sweltering, for as long. And in the nights, it can be pleasantly cool. And that kind of makes you think like it's fall. So after dark is fall. This weekend is going to be hot. It's going to be like 100 or something like that. So, but, you know.
Yes, it is definitely hot. And what else is hot? This case. Because as I was sending it to you, I was like, this is such a good case. It is. And it'll actually roll into another one that we're going to do, too.
It does. And you know what? One of the things, and you're great at picking out cases like this, and, you know, you'll send me links of stuff and about it. And so I was reading this newspaper article about it after it was on Unsolved Mysteries. And looking down and stuff, and it said, oh, the police still consider this a suicide. I'm like, what planet are these police on? it was totally bonkers to me. And I think that the reporter who wrote the article was probably at the same time going, okay, I don't think that they know exactly.
You know what planet they're on? Planet payroll. Honestly, like you read it and you're like, okay, they had to be bought off. Because there's no other logical explanation.
There is not at all.
When you read logic tells you that there's no way.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Charles Morgan?
Okay. This guy, this goes back to the 1970s, 1977 to be specific. He told his wife he was a secret agent man, perhaps working for the Treasury. He disappeared off and on. His wife couldn't figure out what was going on with him. And then he told her, I'm leading a double life. One day he disappeared. He didn't come back. He was found dead.
Yeah. And the what you said it there about, you know, going missing and stuff. The first time I was like reading everything, I go, oh, so he vanished. And then, you know, after dropping his kids off at school, and he, besides being this secret agent person, I mean, he was president of an escrow company that dealt in real estate. And apparently at this time in Arizona, in the late 70s, early 80s, there was so much funny money going around that there was a lot of real estates. There were some banks that went under and things like that. But he disappeared after dropping off his daughters at school. And then 3 days later, he shows up at the back door of the house and he was kind of like holding his throat and he motioned for his wife to get pen and paper. And, you know, he looked confused. He looked like he had been beaten up. He had plastic handcuffs around his legs and hands. He was missing a shoe, but he kept holding his throat. And he, you know, he wrote on the piece of paper that his throat had been painted with a hallucinogenic drug that could destroy his central nervous system. I'm not even sure how he wrote all that out.
I'm not either, because he was in a panic. You know, once your throat or any part of your body's painted with that type of stuff, there's been cases where they used tropamine, hydrochloric acid, even LSD to numb people. You can't swallow, you can't drink, you can't do any of that stuff. So it's like kind of like a conscience prison. You know, you can make yourself crazy.
It's like that Martha Rendell person.
Yes, that is a very good kind of like parallel case. But yeah, he was going crazy because he's locked in this prison where he can't even swallow. His wife starts trying to feed him with an eyedropper just to keep him alive. And he's writing on this paper, you know, I'm a secret agent. I don't have any identification because the kidnappers took it from me. His wife's trying to take all this in because she's never heard this stuff before. But in the back of her mind, she knows he has been dealing with some crazy people. You know, he has the escrow business. He may have been doing money laundering with mobsters.
Yeah. And, you know, and she said, you know, I wanted to call the doctor. I wanted to call the police. But he was no. He said, because that would just essentially the entire family would be killed. And I just, can you imagine, like, you want to have a conversation with your husband about this, right? No, you know, they're going to be killed, but they're writing it all down, you know? And
the thing about these cases is that they don't write down the right stuff. It's always this big open field of just unanswered questions. I mean, the woman doesn't ask him, okay, who are they? You know, I need to protect you. Tell me who they are. Tell me exactly what happened. No, all of that is just left a complete mystery. He tells her the very gist. And then he tells her, let's stop riding for a minute. Go move my car around. Go hide it.
Yeah.
I mean, they obviously knew he drove home. So hiding your car is not going to do a whole lot for you. But she's out there moving the car around.
And so, first of all, I mean, if something like this happened to me, whatever agent, whatever mafia, whatever, I'm taking the wife and the two kids and I'm fleeing somewhere. Because, I mean, if they're doing that to you like that, I mean, you know that it's just going to get worse. How does this ever get better for him?
It doesn't. And the thing is, he brought up a really good point. He never moves.
No.
You know, nowhere in the story does it say they packed up and moved or he took his family to a hotel. Nothing like that. They stay at their family residence and they just continue to ride this out. After she nurses him back to health, he continues to be extremely paranoid. He starts wearing a bulletproof jacket. He calls his children school. He says, I'm the only person that's supposed to pick them up. He even tells his wife, I will be the person taking them to and from and no one else.
Yeah. And he told his father, if anything happened to him, that he left behind a letter that explained who was involved. And he even called the school and said, hey, no one can pick up the children except for me. And, you know, in addition to, you know, because he had all this money floating around. And, you know, the mafia at that point had established Arizona as a narcotics pipeline for drug running. I mean, it's right on the Mexican border. And because of all this cash that's, you know, flowing through, then, you know, you need to launder it. And real estate is one of the best ways to do it. And especially back then, because the Arizona law allowed anyone to buy land through blind trust accounts and shell companies. And it means they could launder all the money they wanted to with no means of it being traced.
Yeah, that made it very easy for them to set up a whole racketeering ring. And, it, you know, Arizona became really attractive. If he got caught up in something like that, you know, no wonder he was in trouble.
And apparently his escrow company did like financial and real estate consulting for a couple of mafia families, which reportedly, you know, may have included tips on how to purchase gold and platinum and use it as collateral instead of money. And so that was a really easy way for the syndicate to launder money. And I think he had talked to Ned Warren, who was linked to like this Phoenix land fraud operation. And also a crime boss, the Bonanno family. Am I saying that right? Bonanno?
He's dead. He's not going to come for us. It's fine. But yeah, that guy right there, he's kind of significant to the case. Messing around with the Bonanno guy, you know, they were hooked also like the Colombo crime family. Now that gold bullion scheme was huge.
And this Bonanno guy, I mean, he got caught up by an undercover FBI operation. And then, you know, he got indicted and he refused to testify. And then was jailed for contempt of court and served about 14 months, which doesn't seem all that bad, really.
No, he made out okay, because had he been prosecuted for the racketeering, he'd probably served a lot longer, looking at what they had against him.
Yeah, and if he had, you know, turned on everybody, he'd be dead. So instead, you know, he goes 14 months to jail, and, you know, nothing else happens to him.
Yeah.
So there's this journalist, Don Devereaux, who wrote extensively about Chuck Morgan. And he said, quote, he was around the edges of a couple of very large organized crime groups in Arizona at that time. It was very easy to get in over your head. And I suspect that over the years, Mr. Morgan was in that kind of situation. He was doing perhaps upwards of a billion with a B, dollars of escrow work in bullion and platinum. I mean, that is a ton of money. That just shows you how much money was in this cocaine trade at that time.
This is the part where it becomes like, okay, was Charles Morgan working for these guys or against them? Because he was making out like a bandit. He had money that was running not only through Arizona and the United States, but also money that was coming in from Southeast Asia. And it was a lot. So that time is going to be interesting. And this episode's kind of the primer for other episodes that we're going to talk about down the road. So, you know, think about that. This is a primer for basically the Octopus Syndicate. This is kind of where it kicked off.
Yeah. And because, I mean, and if you've ever watched like Cocaine Cowboys or anything like that, you know, people had so much money and, you know, you could launder as much as you could, but it was just an astonishing amount of cash. And just to think that one guy, and there was suspected maybe like 500 racketeering organizations kind of going on in Arizona at the time, and that this one had $1 billion. But his wife, you know, said that, that Charles had told her that there was money laundering going on, but nothing that he himself was involved in. But he said, you know, the less the girls and you know, the better off you will be. And after 2 months, he vanished again. And his wife received a mysterious phone call 9 days later from an unidentified woman. And this woman said, Chuck's all right. And then Ecclesiastes 12:1-8, and then she hung up. And that's kind of bizarre.
I wonder if she was a mistress, though. You know, he's in a motel room with this woman. She's calling up the wife. She's like, hey, Ruthie, because the wife's name was Ruth. It seems like that she knew Chuck kind of well if she knew that he called his wife Ruthie.
That's true.
And she's kind of mocking her.
Yeah, that's right, saying, you know, he's fine, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And you know, he was discovered dead in his car about 40 miles west of Tucson, and he was wearing a bulletproof vest. And his body was located outside of the car, face down. So, face down. And he had been dead about 12 hours prior to discovery. It's likely that he was kneeling and kind of fell face forward after being shot, which indicates, of course, that someone else was there, not a suicide.
Exactly. And just the whole thing with ballistics. Okay, so he had his right hand, and it didn't have gunpowder on it. There was actually gunpowder on his left hand, which, you know, may have been wiped on there.
Yeah, I mean, and it was, this was a classic execution thing. If you, any kind of movie, get down on your knees, somebody stands up behind you, shoots one bullet through the back of your head. I mean, that's just kind of the way it's always been seen. And the murder weapon was his own gun, but the gun was lying beside him in an unnatural position for a gun to have fallen after being self-inflicted. And first of all, I don't even know how you could possibly do the kind of shot to make it even think that it was suicide. And his fingerprints weren't on there, and he wasn't wearing gloves. So how do you shoot yourself with your left hand and then magically wipe the gun? I mean,
yeah, this is a whole series of just like people using non-dominant hands to shoot themselves. So you would hold the gun with your right hand and then reach over to your left ear and like pretend like you're going to shoot behind it. The guy was shot in the left back side of his head. How do you do that with your right hand and then wipe the gun clean and lay it nowhere near your body?
Yeah, after you shot yourself in the back of the head. But one of the things that was crazy was he had hidden a $2 bill to the inside of his underwear. And the police didn't find that bill. The medical examiner did. But, you know, he probably hid it in anticipation that the police would remove it. But he probably believed, like, the medical examiner wasn't dirty.
And I fully am on board with that because he secures it to the inside of his underwear and he knows that the police are not going to undress him. They just don't do that at the scene. That's something that the medical examiner does. So he must have trusted that person that they would secure that evidence. And you know, since that bill goes on to have the secret cryptic message on it, you know, he knew that she would pass that on to the people that could decipher it, you know, possibly the FBI or in his case, the Treasury Department, since he claimed to work for them.
Yeah, you know, and so it's got at the top, well, first of all, it's got like an arrow pointing to the 8. And then it says Ecclesiastics, spelled wrong, 1-2. And then it has these names on Acevedo, Bejarano, Quijero, Duarte. It looks like Encinas and then Fuente. I mean, it's just, it goes A through G in alphabetical order. And the verses, I guess, of Ecclesiastics were marked by the arrows drawn on the bill's serial number. I mean, but it was the, what made it weird was it was the same Bible verse that this female caller had given to Charles Morgan's wife. And then on the back of the bill, the signers of the Declaration of Independence were numbered 1-7. And then there was a map. And I mean,
and again, he circles the serial numbers on the back, the number 1, the number 8. So that also goes back to the Bible verse. And if you look at the Bible verse and then you compare it to a murder, it's really dark.
Yeah. And also this map. So it appeared to list names and towns, and it led to an area between Tucson and Mexico, to these towns called Robles Junction and Solacity, which were known for their smuggling. And then there was a piece of paper in the vehicle that showed specific directions to his murder scene. I mean, he was killed exactly where he was sent to.
Yes. And those directions were in his handwriting.
Yeah. So, I mean, for a paranoid guy going out to the middle of the desert doesn't sound like the brightest idea.
No, it doesn't. But the kicker for me is what is found lying next to him, that handkerchief with his tooth in it.
Yeah.
I mean, does that not scream tortured?
It does. I mean, like pulling it out or something. I mean, and inside the car was a bunch of ammunition. There was some weapons and CB radios and a pair of sunglasses that didn't belong to Morgan. And the cops noticed that the car was modified so it could be unlocked from the fender.
Is that because he assumed that he could end up in the trunk?
Maybe, you know, so at least I can open it this way. And, you know, you talked about Ecclesiastics, and so that section said, like, remember your creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. And, I mean, it goes on and on and talks about mourners go about the streets, and the golden bowl is broken before the pitcher shattered at the spring, and the dust returns to the ground it came from. I mean, it's dark.
Really is. What do you think about this? Okay, so the guy, he secured a $2 bill to the inside of his underwear. Mm-hmm. Is that in itself signaling money laundering?
That is brilliant.
I mean, that's the only thing I could think about. Money, you know, the guy has money. He's in his laundry.
It's in his laundry. Yeah, I think so. I think it's just the whole, this, you know, thing of eights, you know, where you had Ecclesiastics 1-8, then you had the eight names in alphabetical order. It's just, you know, there's always this significance to numbers all the time. And, you know, he is a, you know, an escrow agent and dealing in numbers and things like that. It was seven. But then on the other things numbered to seven on the back of the bill, the Declaration of Independence. So, I mean, it's 1-8, technically 8-1 is 7. I mean, it could be like that too. It's just,
if you were an agent back then, he may have been housed into the Treasury Department. But these days, if you do counterfeit and stuff with the Treasury, you'd be housed under Homeland Security. You'd be in the Secret Service. They do go after the kind of stuff that Morgan was perhaps wrapped up in. So that's where he would get his whole tracing of serial numbers and it just the whole significance. They call it the Masonic reference. You know, anything to do with bills, serial numbers, you know, that kind of thing. It seems like Morgan was really hung up on the Masonic stuff.
Yeah, he was huge into Masonry. So, you know, I'm sure that probably, you know, played some part of it. And, you know, the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a lot of them were Masonic Lodge members. So that's definitely, you know, a possibility. And his wife said that there's no way that he would have committed suicide because, I mean, the police wanted to call it a suicide and the medical examiner's like, I'm not calling this a suicide. I'll call it unsolved, but I'm not calling it a suicide.
Yeah, the wife, you know, I struggled to understand if she really knew what was going on and she hid it or if she was one of those, you know, just kind of passive, I'll just play it off like, you know, my husband's not doing anything wrong. Because she goes on to say that, you know, she doesn't know a lot about this, but also the sunglasses found in the back of his car. She said, oh, my Chuck would never wear those. I mean, he was gone for multiple days, so he could have purchased the sunglasses at any point. Or if those were left in the car, it could have been like an eye for an eye thing. I tend to think a hitman's not going to, not by design, leave the sunglasses behind.
Yeah, that's not. He writes down the directions, okay, in his own handwriting. So we're assuming that he was driving by himself. And then, you know, he meets somebody, the person kills him. At what point did the tooth get taken out? You know, in that scenario, did the person like take the tooth, did they take the tooth out after he died and put it in the handkerchief and then put it in the car?
A medical examiner would be able to decipher that for sure. It was not in the reports that were made available to me at the time that we recorded this. But if you went and did like a Freedom of Information Act or, you know, even pulled locally, you know, if they're willing to give up those reports, it would tell you if that incision wound like in his mouth was open.
Yeah.
You know, and also the blood would be dripping, I'm sure, from his chin. That would have been all over him. And you could tell if it's a fresh pull or an old pull.
And this reporter, you know, I mean, makes a very sarcastic but telling comment. He said, I've never seen in all my years as a journalist a fellow take himself out in the desert wearing a bulletproof vest and shoot himself in the back of the head. and I mean, it's just,
I mean, he has a point. Who wears a bulletproof vest and goes out to the desert and shoots themselves? The guy had been working for, what, days trying to keep himself alive?
Yes. You know, 2 days after his body was discovered, so a woman called the sheriff's department to say that she was with Morgan inside a hotel room before he died. And she called herself Green Eyes and said she was the same person who had called Chuck's wife, quoting the Bible passage. And she said that in the motel, Chuck had showed her a briefcase containing thousands of dollars in cash. And he told her the money would buy him out of a contract that the mob had put on his life. I think she might have been.
Rines is a hooker.
Yes.
She's a mob hooker. She's calling up the wife. This guy has a briefcase full of cash. Where did he get that from? Did he pull it out of his own savings? You know, that part's always missing from the stories, and it looks high and low. You know, it's important if he pulled it out of his own savings or if someone gave it to him. Because I would worry, you know, was it the Secret Service that gave him the money trying to buy him some time? Was it the mob who gave him the money? Because I read it was like upwards of $60,000.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, $60,000, is that going to get you out of the hit? It obviously didn't. But, you know, is he sharing? I don't know, because I guess he's... I got my issues with Green Eyes here.
Either she's a lover or she's involved. Because why would he tell her such sensitive information?
Exactly.
You know, she could have killed him and taken the money.
Exactly. Or just waited, you know, if he went to take a shower or something, grab the briefcase and go. But he said that the mob had hired a hitman and he was going to buy them off. But the briefcase of money wasn't recovered at the scene. So obviously he did meet someone there. And the theory is that organized crime put the word out that they wanted him dead. And then the hitman said, hey, come up with the money to buy me off. But when the two of them, you know, met, took the money and killed him anyway, which seems very mob-like, very hitman-like.
It does, but leading up to his death, Morgan was being kind of sketchy. He had kept these papers behind that he had labeled insurance, and they were actually illicit property deeds of where he'd done land transactions for the mob. They weren't kosher at all, and he may have used them against them if he had thought they'd taken a contract out on him to buy himself some time. They didn't like that, and they whacked him anyways, like this whole case. It's not just him doing one thing wrong. You know, as we move through the story, it's a trifecta of multiple things. Don't threaten the mob with documents.
And here's where I wonder, I don't know if he was necessarily a government, like an actual Treasury agent, rather than somebody who was more like an informant or just helping out the government. Because I feel like if he was an actual Treasury agent who had proper training and, you know, had supervisors to call on if he needed to, that he would have been better at it. Because, you know, the reporter said, you know, there's a great likelihood that he was, in fact, doing something with the government. But then goes on to say, I think this was a guy who was extremely naive about a lot of things.
Yeah, I don't think he was trained. I don't think he was an agent of any sorts. I think he was an informant, and they realized he was wrapped up in this, and he was approached. I don't think it was ever his idea. They just said, look, this is what's happening. You know, we see that you're all wrapped up in this. You know, you're basically acting as their financial consultant.
So you're going to jail.
You're going to jail, or you're going to work for us. And he became a reluctant witness, that's the thing, for the attorney general in a case that was against some mobsters.
Yeah. And after his death, you know, his widow was visited by a couple of men who claimed to be FBI agents. And this is where this kind of story kind of fades, at least at the fact that they're FBI agents, because they turned the house upside down looking for something, but they wouldn't answer any of her questions. They didn't say their names. She didn't get a card. I mean, the FBI, if they were really FBI, they would have left a card, you know.
They would have left a card when they come in. They would have shown you identification. They had also placed you outside the door. You would not be just sitting in there on your couch watching them go through stuff. How these men moved through her home was sloppy and unprofessional, so they obviously were not with the FBI. And the fact that she doesn't ask them the right kind of questions, and she's in there, her four daughters are in there. Don't let people in your house if you don't know who they are.
And let me tell you that if the FBI was actually searching for something, it wouldn't have been two people. It would have been like 20.
Right. I have no doubts that that $2 bill meant something to his circle. I don't think it was very helpful to his wife or his father. I do think his father told someone about the note and they came in looking for it.
And the thing is, you would think that the attorney, of course, is going to get a proper look at the FBI, you know, identification. He's going to write down their names. That's a lot different than a woman at home with their two kids when FBI agents show up at the door.
Yeah, except he's not a normal attorney. He's a mobster attorney. So, you know, how many questions is he asking, or was he in on it too? Because that guy's sketchy.
But the reporter seems to think that the FBI opened a case and they were just pretending that they didn't know. The FBI, I think, would have, you know, come up with some kind of, instead of saying no, would have given like a one-page report and the entire thing would have been redacted or something like that.
Probably. I mean, we know that the FBI is always interested in organized crime.
Yeah, for sure.
They constantly stay up in it. Even though they have to stand down, they monitor them like crazy. And they do their best to try to convert them into informants. You know, as far back as crime syndicates go, they always have an eye in to that whole club.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, it was around this time that Morgan was a reluctant witness for the state attorney general. And it was a state land fraud case. And it involved a known organized crime boss and a bank that didn't exist any longer. And it was essentially around a secret state investigation on illegal activity on both sides of the Arizona-Mexico border. And that's when he told people that he was working undercover with the Treasury Department. I mean, you don't tell people that.
No. And if he was really honestly an agent of any sort, he would know that. And that's what makes me think that he is more of a informant.
It doesn't seem... You know, if they were torturing him and removing the tooth or the other stuff to get the documents, would he be really traveling from motel to motel with these documents, knowing that I would think that he would keep them in a safe place rather than, you know, taking them around with him? And if from the wife, it seems like they were looking for one particular thing rather than, you know, bank records or deposits or anything that could, you know, link stuff. Where were all these records? Were they in the escrow office? You know, things like that.
I believe they were on him, because when you look at him and you look at other men we'll go on to talk about, like Danny Casolaro, they were sloppy. They carried everything around with them in a briefcase. They bragged about what they had. They showed it to the other people. They allowed people to come into their homes, their rooms, their offices, and these papers would be out in full view, and they didn't care. So that's what tells us that none of these people were trained. They're not actual agents. They weren't actually working for the government in an official capacity. They are assets and informants, if anything.
So one of the crazy things about the police in this case, other than them saying they thought it was a suicide, but then that doesn't explain their thing. Then they said, well, the $2 bill or the coded messages were left behind for the Treasury Department and FBI to decipher. You know, that doesn't really go with the whole suicide thing. And I'm, you know, putting it on the inside of my underwear. You know, he wouldn't need to do that if it was a suicide. He would just, you know, leave a note or just leave it on a piece of paper explaining kind of things. You know, perhaps it was information about the crime syndicate. And I don't know. The reporter thinks the $2 bill is a, you know, some kind of code. But again, what was the document that the $2 bill is going to unlock?
Well, see, that's the thing. Without having a primer, it's... It's too cryptic. You know, if he left that $2 bill behind for his wife or his kids or whatever to figure out, it's useless because there's no primer for figuring any of that stuff out. Some of the people think that the names on the back in Spanish are smuggling names or perhaps agents that turn dirty. There's no information to really support that. Those are just some of the theories.
Yeah. Well, also, they're in alphabetical order, one for each letter of the alphabet. So it feels more like a code rather than, you know... What are the odds that there's, you know, A through F? It could be agents, and each agent got assigned, you know, a code name, and, you know, started with A and went all the way to F. You know, his death was, you know, reportedly connected to the murder of Doug Johnston and the death of this journalist, Danny Casolaro, like you said. But all three of the cases remain unsolved. And Charles's wife, Ruth, died of cancer in 2006. And the daughters, you know, they say, hey, our dad was murdered to protect the interests of corrupt businessmen and politicians. That's an interesting angle. You know, one of the daughters said, my father had a lot of information about people here in Tucson that could have been very detrimental. There was a lot of information about politicians. People are still alive. They work in our government. He had that information and they wanted to silence him.
Yet he left nothing behind that would indicate that any of that stuff was true. I know they want their father to be a hero, but there's also the flip side of, was this guy, did he have grandiose dreams of being, I don't know, a national treasure? Was he trying to be something that he wasn't? Because when you look at the $2 bill, it seems very fanciful. It doesn't make sense. The names were never linked to anybody in his life. So how did he know those names? You know, was he making all this stuff up? That's an argument. Since the guy testified and he was mobbed up in some capacity, I think there might be something to it.
I just, you know, it's, they had it on Unsolved Mysteries, like I said at the beginning. And his, at the time, his got the most tips out of any, you know, episode ever. There were 600 tips through this hotline. And some of the tips linked back to Wilcox, Arizona real estate schemes and a man named Jack Tillman, who Morgan did business with. And Tillman was so terrified after Morgan's death that he purchased a gun and made phone calls to all the players he assumed were involved. And he was told that as long as no one talked, no one else would get hurt. And he said, you know, he died not that long after, in 1981, but apparently stayed quiet about it. He suggested to friends was that Morgan didn't kill himself and that crime bosses were involved. I just, this guy, he's not a hero. Like, you know, like you said, I mean, obviously the kids want him to be. But these tips kept coming in and coming in and coming in about, you know, men being in over their head and funny money schemes with bankers and lawyers and the mob. And then Morgan had bragged about having all these, you know, illicit land transaction documents that he'd labeled insurance. But, you know, where are they? You know, do we think that he had them? Who do we think got them?
The mob. Because he carried a briefcase. All of these men that we will go on to talk about carried briefcases full of just treasure trove documents. They all have documents taken off of them. I tend to think someone was going around collecting them. You have the FBI operating in the background. They say they're not looking into these cases, but they are.
Do you think that all these years later, I mean, this Devereaux guy, you know, he worked for Unsolved Mysteries. I wonder, like, if somebody did a Freedom of, I don't know, has somebody done a Freedom of Information thing lately on this guy to see if they get anything? You know, just...
It's a series of documents becoming, that go from classified to declassified, back to classified, much like with Robert Maxwell. You know, you go to pull something before you get it, it's classified again. Mm-hmm. These stories are kind of all lopped into one. And there's a lot of that going on. Also, when you do Freedom of Information Act, they have redactions still. And also, they'll say that they're missing copious amounts of paperwork. So if they don't have them, then you can't have them.
On these tips, there were some people who reported seeing him run from someone. And then this particular tip, I think, it was a good one because it said that he also was moving from motel to motel before his murder. And Green Eyes backed up that he stayed at multiple motels. I mean, this seems like a guy who was trying to, he was on the run, essentially, and just trying to stay alive. And I guess I'm also wondering, like you said earlier, where did he get the cash from? You know, was it just cash that he had in his office? Was it? I don't think he took it out of the bank because, you know, there would be some kind of bank records that he had a $60,000 withdrawal or something like that.
Yeah, and also I believe his wife would be able to see that kind of information. And the fact that he went to a motel room and operated outside of her, you know, kind of covertly, he's in there with this mistress. He's has this briefcase full of cash. We don't know where the cash came from. They never really make that clear. I don't know. This guy's just operating outside of his family. He's taking care of himself and he's moving himself from motel to motel, but he never moves the family. For a guy that is a part of a network making billions, we assume he was making his cut of millions. Yeah. Why did he not just move? Was he in debt? I mean, what was going on there?
That's what I don't get. Because, like I said, the first time when he comes home like that, I'd be done. I'd be like, okay, I might end up dead, but I'm going to, move my family and get them out of here. So at least they'll be safe.
Or because at least hire them some security or something. I mean, if he was mobbed up, he knew guys that could be bouncers for the family. He doesn't send anyone to the home. And that always strikes me as just very curious.
So this Don Devereaux guy, like I said, he worked for Unsolved Mysteries. And at the time, he wasn't afraid to kind of like deep dive mysterious investigations. So he had looked into the 1976 car bombing of a Phoenix journalist. And then in 1991, he was contacted by a reporter from Washington, D.C. named Danny Casolaro. And he's the one who gave him the information about Charles's money laundering. So then Casolaro linked Charles Morgan's gold scheme and money laundering to, allegedly, a rogue CIA agent, two foreign governments, and someone in the U.S. Department of Defense. And it kind of, like you said, what we're going to talk about, it rolls kind of right into this octopus syndicate and their tentacles. But then, right after he gets this information, Casolaro is dead. And what he was investigating then led to a body count of over 18 dead witnesses. I mean, so obviously there was something going on. And, for Casolaro to link all of this to the CIA and foreign governments and the Department of Defense, and then he dies and 18 other people are dead. But detectives refused to investigate it. And cold case detectives are told not to attempt it.
Oh yeah. Anytime anyone gets anywhere near the octopus or anything to do with Danny Casolaro or even Charles Morgan, they are contacted by intelligent agencies. If they like you, if they find you to be a likable person, they'll say you might not want to do that. You know, we're trying to save your life. You need to back off.
So in 1990, there's this Phoenix guy named Doug Johnston, and he was shot behind the left ear. Sounds familiar. While parking his vehicle in the lot of this computer graphics company he worked at. And since his wallet and other valuables were left behind, the murder resembled a professional hit, even though it seemed like he didn't really have any enemies. Police, of course, I guess they just don't want to, like, unless it's open shut or something, they didn't want to deal with it. So they said, oh, he committed suicide. But he, too, was right-handed, and ballistics didn't support that he did it. It said that he was shot by a gun that was held 12 inches from his head. So a right-handed guy, think about that, taking it, okay, let me get it 12 inches, let me bring it over to my left side, and then get that. You can't do that.
No, it's so awkward. Just do the maneuver yourself. Take your right hand, try to reach behind your left hand, and then assume that you're holding the barrel of a gun. You just can't do it. It's weird. But the thing is that this guy shoots himself, right?
Yeah.
There's no gun at the scene.
Well, Charles wiping off his hand. This guy, he shot himself in the head and then tossed the gun somewhere and then he laid down to die.
The magical missing gun. And yet police are like, yeah, it's a suicide.
I mean, but how can the police actually, just say that? It's just, to me, it's just like, it was a suicide. Okay, so we've got the gun. Well, no, there's not actually a gun per se. It's just
like, well, maybe someone stopped by the murder scene. They reached in, they took the gun. They didn't want to mess with the Weekend at Bernie's guy and they took off. No, that did not happen. The guy did not kill himself. And the thing is that in all of these cases, again, this will serve as the primer for other stuff. They always have this weird, if you shot yourself, the gun residue would go on your hand. This is more like smearing, from my understanding. So these people are always smeared on their left hand, which tells me that the gunman is right-handed, and he's also nervous.
Yes.
Because he's trying to distance himself from each of these crime scenes, because you have right-handed guys shooting themselves with their left hands. No, he's right-handed. He's trying to make it look like, it's got nothing to do with him. So he's sloppy. He must be like a bargain basement hitman.
Well, it turns out that this Don Devereaux guy lived directly across the street from the parking lot and drove a similar car as Johnston. And the CIA sent word of warning, I guess, through his colleague journalists expressing warning for him to back off and watch his back. And they explained that a contract had been put out in his life, likely because of his investigation into the Morgan case and also helping Danny Casolaro. And Casalero had received the same warning. And Devereaux said, you know, years later, they're still out there. But since Johnston and Devereaux both drove similar-looking Toyota station wagons, and there was only a one-digit difference in the addresses of Devereaux's house and the computer graphics company, and this is where you get your bargain basement contract killer, it seemed like they might have mistaken Johnston for Devereaux and murdered a completely innocent man. I mean, that's essentially what it seems like. I mean, it seems like the contract hit was never carried out on Devereaux. He's still alive today. But no one undercovered, you know, who was responsible for the deaths of Chuck Morgan or Doug Johnston. I think that, Devereaux, obviously, he, you know, sharing the story and that he was being targeted, but he hasn't completely stopped talking about the situation at all.
He never stopped talking about it, and Unsolved Mysteries went on to cover each of these cases. And they covered it very well. I do think in the background that he sent word either through the CIA agent that could contact his colleague to give him the heads up, or he just put it out there. I'm not going to deep dive these anymore. You know, I'm not looking to per se solve them. You know, I'm just going to talk about them because there's some reason why that hit just melted away.
You know, and I think it's 100% correct that, you know, that it was just the odds that the two neighbors across the street from each other have Toyota station wagons.
It happens all the time. When you look at the Oklahoma City bombings, there was a guy who was in prison. He was murdered in prison. He was hung, but he didn't do it. It was a setup. It was some deep state thing, which it's not a conspiracy. The government came out and talked about it, but he was misidentified. They thought he was a guy on film who looked exactly like another guy. I mean, they even had the same tattoo, but at the end of the day, completely mistaken identity. They whacked the wrong guy. So this kind of stuff, it happens.
It does. And this is one of my favorite stories about, like, weird stuff. And it was on that TV show Border Security. And I forget the exact color. But this guy has his, you know, he gets pulled over by customs or whatever. And they're searching his suitcase. And there's drugs in it or something. And he goes, this is not my suitcase. And they go, what are the odds that there's another purple, blue, black, silver, you know, suitcase that's out on there? Well, they go out there, and sure enough, there's an identical suitcase. It's exactly the same, and that was the one that belonged to the guy. And I mean, it was just the most bizarre-looking suitcase ever. And there was another one, and you know, so they let him go, and it's the same kind of things. And I guess, you know, with this hitman, but I wonder why they didn't go after Devereaux again. Then do they just said, okay, well, that's going to really put some pressure because, you know, what are the odds that somebody, you know, across the street gets murdered and then the other person gets murdered across the street and then they both look like hit jobs? And then the police calling every single one of these a suicide.
I mean, obviously someone in the police department is on the payroll. As far back as history goes, officers have been on mob payrolls. That's not unheard of. But this Devereaux guy, in my opinion, have no way to prove it. I think he in the background was working to get himself out of it. Once he found out about the hit, you know, he asked probably someone in intelligence, how do I work my way out of this? And they said, let us teach you how to distance yourself and reframe this. You know, you're just an Unsolved Mysteries writer. You're going to put it out there for entertainment purposes, but you're not looking to solve it. Because, again, Devereaux never goes on to solve anything.
No.
And it's probably because he likes to breathe air.
Yes. So. Well, you got an 18-person body count. You know, you're going, okay, you know, I think I'm done with this now. I'm just going to go do a different TV show or something. The fact that it just goes from this Morgan and just the, I mean, to come home to your wife, let's talk about that for a second. Morgan doesn't move them. But if you're the wife and your husband comes home like that and, you know, with the handcuffs and can't talk and is beat up and all of this stuff, aren't you going to say, you know, you do you, but I'm going to take myself and the kids and we're going to go somewhere else?
Yes, and yet she never does. So to me, did she know more information than she let on? Because the only way that you would not move and you would not ask any more questions is if you were already satisfied, if you had some type of answers.
Yeah, it just it blows my mind. And I'm excited to see, you know, as Jen said, this is the primer for some episodes that are coming. So it will all kind of go together in a series. And it just... to see from going from Morgan in the handcuffs to then you know, with Devereaux, you know, and all of these people with, you know, contracts, and it just, obviously there was a lot going on. You know, when you're talking billions of dollars, there's a lot of people who want to protect that and don't want to have that exposed. And $1 billion buys a lot of body counts. So
it does.
Oh, good one. You found a good one. And I can't wait till next week.
Me either. We'll continue on this whole masterclass of what not to do.
So everybody, have a great weekend, and you too, Jen, and we will talk next week.
Yeah. Have a good weekend. Stay safe.
Bye.
Bye.